Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 193, being recorded on the 30th of August, 2017, with special guest Chris Kent. I'm Street, and on Skype with me, I have Kale, Evan, and our special guest. And as usual, we'll do a quick recap of all the updates this week in the Azure space. Before we get started with our special guest, who is from a company that we've actually had on before, but we'll get to that in a minute. So, Kale, good to have you back. And we missed you when we were talking about some blockchain stuff last week.
Nice.
Of course, I should mention that we took a week off for the summer break. As our listeners would know, I did put that on our Twitter feed in case people are wondering what happened to us this week. We're not gone. We're still here. We just took the week off. So, Kale, there's been some good updates in the blockchain space. I thought maybe you'd like to pick that up.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a little bit old news now at this point. It's been a couple of weeks, I think now 2 weeks maybe, but Mr. Marcinovich had made the trek over here to New York to unveil the Coco framework. It's pretty exciting stuff. Essentially, from a real high level, and we should probably, you know, talk in depth about this at some point, but it's basically a framework that sits on top of these enterprise blockchains and allows, solves some of the issues that they're trying to solve. So everybody's, the two big ones that people are trying to solve is speed and transaction speed, as well as privacy of these transactions and how to control that, or more like closer to an RBAC model. And so this is a framework that sits above a blockchain. Blockchain's not even aware that it's being, you know, talked to from Coco. So pretty kind of unique offering in the space. And it's still early, but we did show and prove out that we've run this on actual hardware and have the software to do this.
Now, when they say it's a framework, is there a programming aspect to it as well?
Yeah, so basically it's going to encompass a bunch of different things. The two primary use cases I just mentioned, but it's implemented through a series of hardware and software. Some of it are partners with Intel in the SGX processors and or hardware chips rather in the machines, as well as, you know, some things that we have in the Windows virtual secure mode and different things we have inside of Azure to make those actually work. It's interesting though that it's not dependent 100% on Azure. You could run this on premises, if you like, or whatnot.
Yeah. If you have the right hardware.
That's right.
Yeah, and it's just that you could create that enclave or that protected mode of execution, something like that.
That's part of it, and then the other part of it is a consensus algorithm called Raft, which seems to be the latest rage in blockchain, and primarily because of speed and what it can accomplish. It is pretty awesome, and it works on multiple chains, and we're gonna have it as part of ours too.
Very good. Excellent. Okay, so, you know, there was an update in the Azure storage space. You know, it's one of the oldest services that Azure offers. It's good to know they're still putting updates out on that one. And one of them right now is they offer the archival of Blob Storage. So
you this know. Is like, what, even cooler than cold?
Yeah. Nice. I mean, yeah, and that's the other update, right? Is they're offering this blob level tiering, so you could specify whether you want hot or cool tier of data. I guess hot is something that you need access to very quickly, whereas cool means, you know, you're willing to take a slight hit on it, on the latency of that data. So they've kind of made that such that there's an API now. So when you're inserting your records, you can say, oh, this record item, by the way, is, you know, something for archival, or, you know, it's cold or hot. Or you can specify that in your .NET library.
So that's the big extension, though, right? Because the Azure Archive, right, it's cooler than cold, but now you can do it at a per blob level. It used to be at a per either container or account level.
Account level. Which it was. Yeah, I think it was account level. Yeah.
So now it's much, much more granular, so I can have stuff within the same storage account that's multiple tiers. Oh, that's nice.
Exactly. Yeah. So I thought that was pretty neat.
Yeah.
I saw some stuff on the SQL side, Evan.
Yeah, this is so I thought this was really interesting. So we're, as always, we're continuing to add, storage and performance capabilities to SQL. But what we've actually done is, so it used to be that, and I think this is still in preview, but it used to be, right, when you specify your database, that's kind of your size, right? Your S1 is, or S3 is a certain database DTUs and a certain storage size. And that's it. If you needed more, you had to go up in terms of SUs. Well, now you have the ability to, where you're, in essence, it looks like we're unmarrying DTUs and storage, right? So now you have a limit on your storage, but you can go up in chunks up to that limit, right? So I think that really gives you the ability to, like I said, disassociate your DTUs from your storage because they're totally independent concepts, right? If you think about it, I might have lots of data but have low use, or I could have very little data, but man, I could really be churning through in terms
Hammering
of
it,
resources. Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
So, how is that implemented, like for our users who or listeners who would want to take advantage of this? Is this, do they still just go in? I'm sorry, I'm slightly confused. Do they still pick like an S1, S2, whatever, like kind of stuff there? Or how does this actually work? Because if the DTU thing is decoupled from it, or is there like two choices now or something like that?
Well, yeah, so you're paying per storage above and beyond the base storage amount, right? So think about it like the same way we do, now it escapes me, one of the other services that does it. But so you go and you
MongoDB.
say, yeah, maybe, but I mean, you go and you say, hey, I'm going to do, actually, we do this a lot of services. We have some like base number of, requests, right, for storage that's free, and then past that, right, we start charging. So you pick your database DTUs that comes with, let's call it, 250 gigs of storage, but you can go up to a terabyte, and anywhere between the terabyte and 250, you're going to pay, some amount of money per gigabyte per month, right? So it used to be, right, here was your size and you were paying for your size, done, right? And if you needed more, you had to pay for that more. Now you can kind of granularize it as you go through, right, in
I see.
chunks.
I see. Okay, yeah. So it's not such a hard stop then. If you said, hey, I'm on an S1 and you max it out, I mean, you're like, you have no choice. You're going to an S2 and you're getting more performance even though you might not need it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I mean. That's what I was trying to get at. Maybe I said it not quite clearly, but in terms of decoupling to some extent, right? There's still a little bit of coupling, but to a large extent, we're saying, hey, you can go through your DTUs, but you don't necessarily need to use the higher storage.
That's cool.
Excellent. Good stuff. And then I think Kayla introduced this a while ago where the Visual Studio team puts out these regular digests of all the updates that have they've introduced. And as usual, there's a whole bunch in August that they release. Some pretty cool ones, actually, which one of them is like the release definition editor. You know how painful it can be to define your release process. And so they have they've created like a visualization of the pipeline, the entire pipeline as it goes from step to step. Now you can, it's kind of like a Visio diagram almost that it'll show you what it is instead of just looking at an XML file or JSON file like they had before. And then there's the in context configuration UI for some of the configuration elements and some of the artifacts that they have in there. They've got some enhancements for applying deployment templates. There's an improvement in the task in the phase editor that's part of the VSTS. Some new support for release with Jenkins, continuous integration, and so on and so forth. So really, there's a lot of support for the third-party providers, Ansible, for code, CodeHub, etc. Lots and lots of updates coming out. So put a link to that. But those guys are not staying still for sure.
Not in the least.
That thing's like it's like an operating system over there now, man. I
I
mean,
know.
it's like it
It
just
is.
grows and it's awesome stuff, but it's almost hard to keep up with. I'm glad you're putting these things out.
Absolutely. Yep. Good. So that was a good roundup of all the latest news. And I think we can now get to our special guest. So let's see. Chris, could you please introduce yourself for our listeners and then we can kind of take the discussion from there.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Chris Kent, and I am the product marketing manager for Vault, and I am from HashiCorp.
Great. And we did have Megan from HashiCorp on a while ago. She talked about some of the services that you guys had. But today we want to talk about specifically about managing secrets in the cloud, right, which is a hot topic. I'm sure a lot of people have to deal with it. And so you mentioned a product called Vault that you have. So give us a feel for, you know, why this product is something that you guys felt you had to build. Like, what is the problem that you're trying to solve that people are probably facing today, and that Vault offers a solution for?
Yeah, thanks. There are actually quite a few, like, when we'll talk about kind of three primary use cases, but really the way that if you look at the migration from kind of like static to dynamic infrastructure, one of the biggest pieces of that is trying to make sure that an organization's secrets are secure. And a secret really can be, you know, an array of different things. So it could be tokens, API keys, user passwords, those kinds of things. But really one of the biggest challenges in that space is secret sprawl, right? So once you start kind of scaling infrastructure out, or you're adding team members or different access points, you really start to have the vulnerability of where you're having secret sprawl, right? So you're as the complexity of your environment is growing, you don't want to necessarily have secrets that are stored either on individual machines, or you're going to have, you know, information that is specific to certain data sets. It's really trying to eliminate the complexity around that to where you're having kind of a single source there. And then part of that as well is when you start to get to this kind of fractured infrastructure or kind of multi-tiered infrastructure, the idea of data traveling between those is, you know, you're losing the security that you used to once have with the, you know, kind of the castle moat approach, which was everything lived in one box. And so you had the security that could just really kind of sit on the outside and protect the whole device, you know, unless someone maybe had been an intruder inwardly. But when in the microservices kind of framework and in the world that we're going with multi-cloud, the difficulty there is that you maybe have a database sitting in one server. You may have the application layer sitting a different layer. And so like really having those two be able to communicate with each other, you want to be able to also ensure that that data is being encrypted both ways. And then really kind of the third primary use case for Vault is access management, right? So you want to be able to control the access to the secrets, but you also want to be able to, let's say, dynamically create tokens, or you want to be able to revoke maybe either on a time base, or you have, you know, teams that fluctuate, or you have access points that change. You want to be able to dynamically shift with that, so you can manage those and be a broker for that kind of a technology, if you will.
Are you talking about, when you talk about that access, are you talking about it's one of the things that we're, you know, we're trying to optimize our use of internally is, you know, just-in-time access, right? Is make sure that, I mean, that can be really problematic to manage. Because if I need it and I can't find anybody to approve it, that's probably, right. I mean, when you talk about the dynamic access, is that kind of in essence what you're talking about?
Yeah. So there, and it's all kind of policy driven in that regard. But yeah, like the idea is, you know, with the identity, like the idea around either identities or kind of like the, you know, auditing abilities or brokering, you could say, hey, this application needs to be able to create these, you know, this access point or this token or whatever it is, and maybe it's a time to live that's attached to it, or maybe it's an access number, right? So maybe, you know, one access point, or and it could also be managed from either the kind of the application or like the UI or from an organization as well, so that you could also audit what, you know, kind of access points are being seen, or anytime something's being accessed, or anytime a secret's being either requested to be kind of unsealed or whatnot, like that is also logged. So there's a bunch of different kind of pieces of that. But yeah, the idea around it is, especially the dynamic side, is being able to do the revocation and leasing in a dynamic capability. So whether it's application driven or user driven or whatever that might be, yeah, the idea is being able to tightly control that.
Nice, yeah, because that's the, I mean, who hasn't, you know, we didn't kind of go into some of the interests on our side, but I'm in support, and I have had many times where, you know, I'm helping a customer, you know, do something, and, you know, I don't see this as much anymore, as much these days as it used to be, because a lot of the UIs these days, when people type in their passwords, right, it's starred and the like, but there's still lots and lots of config files running around out there where people are putting passwords, like, no, I don't want to see that, please take that off the screen, I don't. You know, so I mean, it's a real, I mean, what you're talking about trying to solve is a real problem for people.
Yeah. And that's, it really is a real world scenario that we were trying to solve for our own kind of edification, if you will. Like that is the idea, right? Like part of why, at least from my own personal, like kind of side of things, one of the reasons I love the product that I manage in the company is that they really are solving a real world problem, right? And so I've also experienced that in my previous careers that, you know, whether it's in Chef config files or even in just Excel spreadsheets back in the day, like, you know, like, it's dangerous. And now with the way that the like nature of computing, like those things that once we could kind of hold off in our own little corner, they're being largely exposed, and that's dangerous.
Yeah. No, yeah, that's a good point. I actually still remember the corporate password for a company I used to work for years back, just because I can't get it out of my head now. And I bet $5 they haven't changed it all these years later.
Oh, yeah. You know it's hard-coded in so many different places.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure.
So, you know, this is not a problem that's specific to the cloud, is it? I mean, I guess even in a data center, on premises, you probably also face similar issues, I suppose.
Yeah, and it really is, and that's kind of like, so HashiCorp is kind of a kind of overarching look is we're looking at that kind of shift. Like, you know, the customers are taking, like I said earlier, from the kind of like static infrastructure to dynamic, but it still includes static, right? So it still includes the on-prem, it still includes the data centers, the VMs, the, you know, configuration management stuff. Like it's really kind of, we try to be able to solve that problem on any different level. We don't necessarily kind of specify where that is, because it is something that I think persists on all different kind of levels and organization sizes, and whether it's an individual practitioner or a large company, I think the kind of the historical approach to it is very similar. And that's kind of part of the difficulty around it is reshaping how we think about like secret storage and secrets management and, you know, reducing like text-based, whether it's either in a configuration thing or putting database credentials in a, you know, server side web page, like, I mean, whatever that might be, like,
right.
it's kind of looking at how we're doing that. But yeah, it's really on all different sizes.
Yeah, Chris, I'm interested. You mentioned a lot about like the auditing capabilities, like, you know, being able to not only allow these things to work and get grant access when they need to, but also like following up and making sure the proper alerts are sent out when certain events happen and things like that. But I'm interested too, is there anything you could share around like a kind of a click down on how are these things actually stored? Is this like an appliance? Is this like just a piece of software? How do customers, when they deploy this, what are they actually kind of getting out of that?
Yeah, so similar to where or how Vault like kind of sets up, it's either, you know, authentication or secrets backend. It's really at the discretion of the people implementing it. So the idea is we could store it in, you know, a syslog. It's really like wherever you guys want to store it. But the idea is, yeah, any time that someone is kind of looking to, or, you know, requesting an unseal, requesting any kind of access to any different pieces within Vault, it will store that. And then really it's, you know, it's searchable, but it's not reversible. And then lookup of HMAC values is supported. But it's more pluggable within like the audit backend. So you can actually integrate with different systems of your own choosing. And really the point of that is Vault as a whole generally doesn't want to like kind of hold anything to itself, if that makes sense. And that's more of a security thing than anything. So it's not a kind of a vulnerability within itself. But the idea is, yeah, it logs it somewhere. So it could be, you know, some kind of logging endpoint that you specify. It could be, you know, some kind of data backend. But it's really pretty modular in that regard.
Nice. And the other question I had is a common use case, and I think you guys kind of solve for this pretty well, is, you know, using a kind of a secret storage mechanism and authenticating to it as a human is one thing, but having an application or maybe like a build system or something like that, where I'm interested, do you guys have like sort of like an API key kind of thing where basically you can have those kind of lights out things that are actually accessing and retrieving those secrets and whatnot?
Yeah, so it's really like you can store, I mean, the secrets really kind of encompass a lot of different factors. So it could be API keys, it could be passwords, it could be certificates, username, passwords. But yeah, so the API keys is similar in that it can be controlled, and how the authentication mechanism is kind of integrated with that. It could be tied, like you said, directly to an API key. It could be an like application or authentication token. So it's really kind of the choosing of the integrator.
Cool.
So you know, one of the things, so I hear you talk about this, you know, so Azure, right, has Key Vault, which has some of the functionality that you're talking about secrets, but it doesn't have anywhere near the management stuff. It feels like as we talk about this, like, you know, when you talk about integrating with storage and stuff, you know, Key Vault's kind of a bare bones that somebody could, not necessarily, you know, that it would be easy, but conceptually they could build some of your features and functionality on top of. But really what you guys are layering in is a lot of the management, the auditing, all that kind of stuff. Is that the right way to think about that?
Yeah, that's correct. So really the kind of like the three use cases we talked about at the beginning, like that's kind of the three verticals that we look at when we're addressing either new features or even the creation of Vault itself is at the core, it's secrets management, right? Like yep. That is the, you know, the primary tenant, if you will. But really, once we started working within that, that's where the access management and the encryption as a service kind of came in, and they were natural or organic additions, because really, once you start getting to secrets management, where the encryption as a service came into play, was that, well, if you're on a one machine, it makes sense. You don't need it. But like if you're at all distributed, either within a data center or multi-cloud, like you need the ability to also like make sure that the data is not only encrypted at rest, but during transit, which is also a big piece of that. So whether you know, that secret's coming in and out, you want to make sure that that's also safe. But then the access management is also the secondary, or I guess tertiary, if you will, in the discussional side of things. But the way that it's set up is that we also wanted to say, hey, we have these incredibly valuable data sets that we need to, A, we need to make sure they're safe, right? So that's kind of the second one. We want to make sure they travel safely, but then we also want to say, hey, we need to be able to revoke them at any point in time. And you're seeing that, I think, also that's kind of a big thing. I think that's popping up in the I don't want to say cloud, but in just the web world in general, is the idea of like OAuth, for example, being able to revoke your access across many different applications or mediums or platforms. And so it's really that kind of concept of, I want to be able to control my secrets. I want to protect them while they're getting to and from where they're going, but I also want to say, hey, I need to shut them all down, or I need to issue them ad hoc, or really kind of that set of, you know, that's, use cases.
That's typically people call that, you know, key rolling or secrets right. rolling, right? Okay. Yep. You know, I mean, so how, this has been one of the, you know, so we do a lot of this in Azure and everything. And like the whole rolling of secrets is a whole new layer on top of your secret management, because it used to be, right, we were talking about this, you know, when you have your password, you hard code it somewhere, and, you know, fingers crossed, you don't have to change it, because now you have to change it in, you know, four or five different places. But now, right, with the, you know, the way that security is handled these days, there is, you know, if you let a security person near your infrastructure, the first thing they're going to say is, hey, that password or that certificate that you're using, you only get to use it for 30 days, and then you get another one, right? And then another one and another one. And so like, not only do you have to manage getting these things in and out, but actually managing, like, the life cycle of these is a whole nother challenge on top of that.
Yeah, and part of that, and I think this is where a lot of there's a lot of value to Vault and the ability for key rolling and the credential leasing and whatnot is that, like, the time to live and the access, right? So, like, being able to say, okay, you only get to use that for an hour, or you only get to use that one time, or, you know, being able to control that dynamically and yeah. systematically, I think, is really important, because then you have a single source of truth, right? Like, you're not saying, like, you can, like, as an organization, you can say, hey, everyone use this to gather your secrets or to generate your credentials or to get your keys, whatever it is, like, everyone uses the same system. Yep. So that way you're also ensuring that you're kind of on par with the same, I guess, regulations, if you will. And so that's where, you know, kind of the managing the managing is really kind of yep. the introspect there.
So there goes my post-it note with my password.
Yeah.
Chris, how do applications kind of authenticate themselves in order to obtain these secrets, you know, and so that other people and other applications, rogue applications, are not getting them?
Yeah, so there are is a unified or kind of a single API endpoint, and so essentially the applications can request a, depending on what it is. So, like, if it's a API key, it's different than, let's say, authentication token, but and then really on the application, or sorry, on the authentication side, there's usually some kind of authentication backend, right? So it could be many different levels. We have kind of a myriad of different integration points there, and then that can be, like, if it's a credential, it can be saying, yes, this kind of either infrastructure or this application has the rights to get this information back, and then you know, the revocation, those kinds of things. But then on the authentic, or like the token side of things, it can be issued a token, and then the token is used for accessing the data, similarly to, like, you could, let's say, access GitHub's authentication backend, right? So, like, you could get a token back, and then that would authenticate you.
I see. So, like, in the case of Azure Key Vault, we use Azure AD, right, as our authentication mechanism. The applications would authenticate against Azure AD, get a token, and then that token is provided to Key Vault in the API, and that's what gives it the RBAC access into the secrets. So you're saying that you guys support, besides Azure AD, you have some sort of an adapter or kind of framework that allows you to get the token from different authentication systems. Is that what you said?
Yeah, so we have the auth backend, which are, again, you can integrate as much or as little of these as you want, but, like, you know, LDAP, Okta, user password, AWS, GitHub, multi-factor, which is something that we just kind of introduced in one of our last releases. So, yeah, there's a lot of different ways of doing it, and that's partly with kind of the roadmap and the feature development for Vault is looking at a big piece of it's looking at what the community is saying and the feedback we're getting there. Right. So, you know, how are people wanting to use this and consume the tool, and what is making their lives easier? Cause a lot of what Vault aims to do is, like what we talked about earlier, is, which is solve a use case, right. Or solve a specific problem. And so, a lot of our kind of either releases or kind of minor releases are continually adding into some of these different pieces, right? So in Vault 0.8, which was, what was that? I think a couple of weeks ago, we released secure plugins, for example. And so what this does is it allows you to create custom integrations for authentication and secret backend now. So rather than wait for necessarily, like, for Vault to release a authentication backend, you could actually, it's like a plugin catalog now that allows you to like kind of simply add on your own. So if you wanted to create your own auth backend, you could do that and then create the custom integration point there.
I see. Okay, very good. And but the focus is secret management, right? Like it doesn't do all the stuff like Azure Key Vault does, encryption and decryption using HSM, for example. That's not something that the Vault offers, correct?
Vault does do HSM. Yes, it's so we have Vault open source, and then we also have like the Vault enterprise side. And so on the enterprise side, we have a bunch of different features that are either more kind of, governance or collaboration based. And so like HSM, like auto unsealing and whatnot is on the enterprise side, as well as like replication, disaster recovery, replication, and multi-factor authentication, mount filters, those kinds of things. Those are on the enterprise side. And those are typically where they're more aligned with the governance or the organizational side of the use case, or at least the problem set, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good. That's very good to know. Yeah, I mean, I think you guys have, definitely covered a wide variety of needs in this space, and it's good to see a very comprehensive approach to solving this problem.
Great. Thank you.
Awesome. So, guys, any more questions before we let Chris go?
Yeah, no, this is great. I mean, it's like we were talking, right, and joking about it. I'd say that we joke a little bit about, the secrets, but I mean, it's a big problem. So, no, thank you for answering all the questions and kind of framing up the use, because it's a key thing that people have to figure out and leverage.
Yeah. Oh, I guess we should have asked though. What's the Azure like deployment story for something like this? Like, is it an image that's available in the gallery, or like, what's the vehicle to get it out there?
Yeah. So there's a couple of different pieces that you can do. So Azure, you can use Azure Storage backend, which is the storage container, and there's a bunch of different components within Azure in terms of the authentication and then the secrets management side. And some of it's community supported. Some of it is obviously Azure supported. And then also it's really, as like I said, with the secure plugins and whatnot, it's really just trying to enable people to really use as much or as little as they want, however they want to do it.
But there's no like central server or service that has to be installed.
In terms of getting Vault like running in Azure.
Yeah.
I mean, you would definitely have to install Vault on either a VM or something like that. But there are no real kind of.
There's already made images to go. You got to.
I don't want to misspeak. I think there might be a ready-made on there. I would have to double check, but I think there might be.
All right. If there is, just give us a link. We'll add it to the show notes after the fact. It's not a problem.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's great. Awesome. Thank you. Yeah. All right. Great, Chris. Again, thanks a lot for coming on and talking about this. I think it's a very important topic. You know, some people don't like to talk about it, but I think it's important that we discuss it, right? It's no secret that secret management is hard.
Oh, you had to go there.
Wow.
Oh, you had to go
Sorry.
There.
It's getting late over here.
No, it was my pleasure. I really appreciate the time. And obviously, this is a topic that we kind of hold very dear to us. And we like talking about it and socializing it as much as possible.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Take care. Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.